I do not say these things for a dollar or to fill up the time while I wait for the boat. It is you talking as much as myself. I act as the tongue of you, tied in your mouth. In me it begins to be loosened. Poetry considers every part of our life, from before birth to beyond death. Poetry's primary concern is not with beauty, not with persuasion, not even with philosophical truth. Poetry's primary concern is with experience, all the daily experiences of our lives. It's about the ball, the bat, the mitt. Ball hits bat or it hits mitt. Bat doesn't hit ball, bat meets it. Ball bounces off bat and flies air or thuds ground, dud. Or it fits mitt. Bat hates to take ball's bait. Ball flirts, bat's late. Don't keep the date. Ball goes in, thwack, to mitt. And goes out, thwack, back to mitt. Ball fits mitt, but not all the time. Sometimes ball gets hit, pa! When bat meets it, and sails to a place where mitt in disgrace has to quit. That's about the bases loaded. That's about 40,000 fans exploded. It's about the ball, the bat, the mitt, the bases, and the fans. It's done on a diamond, and for fun, it's about home and it's about run. Poised between going on and back, pulled both ways like a tightrope walker, fingertips pointing the opposites. Now bouncing on tiptoe like a drop ball or a kid skipping rope. Come on, come on. See how he teeters, skitters, tingles, teases, haunts them, hovers like an ecstatic bird. He's only flirting, crowding, crowding. Delicate, 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 delicate. Now! Teeth bare to the wind, white knuckle grip on handlebars, you push the pedals of no return, let loose new motion and speed. The earth turns with the multiplied force of your wheels. Do not look back. Feet light on the brakes. Ride the bicycle of your will down the spine of the world, ahead of your time into life. I will not say go slow. Do you remember how you won that last race? How you flung your body at the start? How your spikes ripped the cinders? How you catapulted through the tape? Do you remember? Don't you think I lurched with you out of those starting holes? And as you flew into the stretch, was not all my thrill of 1,000 races in your blood? And at your final drive through the finish line, did not my shout tell of the triumphant ecstasy of victory? Live as I've taught you to run, boy. It's a short dash. Dig your starting holes firm and deep. Lurch out of them into the straightaway with all the power that is in you. Look straight ahead to the finish line. Think only of the goal. Run straight, run high, run hard. Save nothing. And finish with an ecstatic burst that carries you hurtling through the tape to to victory. Arithmetic is where numbers fly like pigeons in and out of your head. Arithmetic tells you how many you win or lose if you know how many you had before you won or lost. Arithmetic is 7-Eleven, all good children go to heaven, and 5-6 bundle of sticks. Arithmetic is where you have to multiply. And you carry the multiplication table around in your head and hope you don't lose it. If you ask your mother for one fried egg for breakfast, and she gives you two fried eggs, and you eat both of them, who's better at arithmetic, you or your mother? Poetry leaves us with lots of questions, but it also gives meaning and understanding to our experiences, just the daily experiences of our lives. A snake came to my water trough on a hot, hot day, and I, in pajamas for the heat, to drink there. In the deep, strange, scented shade of the great dark carob tree, I came down the steps with my pitcher and must wait. Must stand and wait, for there he was at my water trough before me. He reached down from a fissure in the earth wall in the gloom and trailed his yellow, brown, slackness, soft belly down over the edge of the stone trough and rested his throat upon the stone bottom. And where the water had dripped from the tap in a small clearness, he sipped through his straight mouth, softly drank through his straight gums into his slack, long body silently. Someone was before me at my water trough, and I, like a second comer, waiting. He lifted his head from his drinking as cattle do, and flickered his tongue between his lips and mused a moment and stooped and drank a little more, being earth brown, earth golden from the burning, burning bowels of the earth. And the voice of my education said to me, he must be killed, for here the black snakes are innocent, the gold are venomous. And voices inside me said, if you were a man, you would take a stick and break him now and finish him off. Must I confess how I liked him? How glad I was he'd come like a guest in quiet to drink at my water trough and depart, peaceful, pacified, and thankless to the burning bowels of the earth. Was it cowardice I dare not kill him? Was it perversity I longed to talk to him? Was it humility to feel so honored? I felt so honored. And yet those voices, if you were not afraid, you would kill him. And truly, I was afraid. I was most afraid. Yet even so, honored still more that he should seek my hospitality from out the dark door of the secret earth. He drank enough and lifted his head dreamily as one who was drunken, and flickered his tongue like two-forked night on the air, so black, seeming to lick his lips, and looked around like a god unseen into the air, and slowly turned his head, and slowly, very slowly, as if thrice a dream, proceeded to draw his slow length curving round and climb again the broken bank of my wall face. And as he put his head into that dreadful hole and snake easing his shoulders entered farther, a sort of horror, a sort of protest against his deliberately going into the blackness, slowly drawing himself after, overcame me now, his back was turned. I looked around and put down my pitcher. I picked up a clumsy log and I threw it at the water trough with a clatter. I think it did not hit him. But suddenly that part of him which was left behind, convulsed in undignified haste, ride like lightning, and was gone. Into the black hole, the earth-lipped fissure of the wall front at which, in the intense still noon, I stared with fascination. And immediately I regretted it. I thought, how paltry, how vulgar, what a mean act. And I despised myself and the voices of my accursed human education. And I thought of the albatross. And I wished he'd come back, my snake. For to me he seemed like a king in exile, uncrowned in the underworld, now due to be crowned again. I have something to expiate, a pettiness, for I missed my chance of one of the lords of life.
Oh, yes, yes. 'Tis very well. You may drunk, I am, think, but I'll tell you, I'm not. I'm sound as a fiddle and fit as a bell. Stable quite ill to tell what's what. I understand you surprise I got when I headed my smear with gooseberry jam. And I've swallowed a grant, a beer of lot. But I'm not so think as you drunk I am. Can I liquor my stand? Why, yes, like hell. I care not how many a tossed I've pot. I'll struck quite late, not yutter an L. And my feet will not spalter the least little jot. If you'd only head on. Well, I gave him a dot and a sergeant, I'll come like a lamb. This floor, it feels like a storm in a yacht. But I'm not so thick as you drunk I am. For example, to prove it, I'll tell you a tell. I once knew a fellow named Apricot. Sorry, I just chair over myself. A trifle. Now this fellow, on a very day hot, if I hadn't consumed that last whiskey of tot, as I said now, this fellow, named Abraham, one more, since it's you, just a doomy will spot, for I'm not so thick as you drunk I am. So, Prince, you suggest I've bolted my shot. Well, like what you say, and so you're damned. I'm an upper lip set at the rot you talk. I'm not so thick as you drunk I am. The shoebox. Stuffed in an old nylon stocking sleeps the baby mouse I found in the meadow, where he trembled and shook beneath the stick till I caught him up by the tail, brought him in, cradled in my hand. A little Quaker, the whole body of him trembling. His absurd whisker sticking out like a cartoon mouse, his feet like small leaves, little lizard feet, whitish and spread wide when he tried to wriggle away, struggling like a minuscule puppy. Now he's eaten his three kinds of cheese and drunk from his bottle-capped water trough. So much he just lies in one corner, his tail curled under him, his belly big as his head, his bat-like ears twitching and tilting toward the least sound? Do I imagine he no longer trembles when I come close to him? He seems no longer to tremble. But this morning, the shoebox house on the back porch is empty. Where is he gone? My meadow mouse. My thumb of a child nuzzled in my palm to run under the hawk's wing. Under the eye of the great owl watching from the elm tree. To live by courtesy of the shrike, the snake, and the tomcat. I think of the nestling fallen into the deep grass. The turtle gasping in the dusty rubble on the highway. The paralytic stunned in the tub and the water rising. All things. Innocent, hapless, forsaken. The next poem by Gwendolyn Brooks is about abortion. She does not take a stand on an abortion issue. She clarifies an experience. Abortions will not let you forget. You remember the children you got that you did not get. The damp, small pulps with a little or no hair. The singers and workers that never handled the air. You'll never neglect them or beat them, silence or buy with a sweet. You'll never wind up the sucking thumb or scuttle off ghosts that come. You'll never leave them, controlling your luscious sigh and return for a snack of them with a gobbling mother eye. I have heard in the voices of the wind, the voices of my dim, killed children. I have contracted. I have eased my dim dears at the breasts they could never suck. I have said, sweets, if I sinned, if I seized your luck and your lives from your unfinished reach, if I stole your births and your names, your straight baby tears and your games, your stilted and lovely loves, your tumults, your marriages, your aches, your deaths, if I poisoned the beginnings of your breaths, believe that even in my deliberateness, I was not deliberate. Why should I whine? Whine that the crime was other than mine, since, anyhow, you are dead. Or rather, or instead, you were not made, but that too, I am afraid, is faulty. What shall I say? How is the truth to be said? You were born, you lived, you died. It's just that you never giggled or planned or cried. Believe me, I loved you all. Believe me, I knew you, though faintly. And I loved you all. Poetry intensifies experience, and to be intensely alive is the opposite of being dead. Curiosity may have killed the cat. More likely, the cat was just unlucky. Or else, curious to see what death is like,
having no cause to go on licking paws and fathering litter on litter of kittens, predictably. Nevertheless, to be curious is dangerous enough. To distrust what is always said, what seems, to ask odd questions, interfere in dreams, to run away, smell rats, have hunches, does not endear him to those doggy circles where well-smelt baskets, suitable wives, and good luncheons are the order of things, and where prevails much wagging of incurious heads and tails. Face it, curiosity will not cause him to die. Only lack of it will. Never to want to see the other side of the hill, or that improbable country where living is an idol, although a probable hell, would kill us all. Only the curious have, if they live, a tale worth telling at all. Dogs say he loves too much, is changeable, irresponsible, marries too many wives, deserts his children, chills all dinner tables with tales of his 9 lives. Well, he is lucky. Let him be 9 lived and contradictory, curious enough to change, and prepared to pay the cat price, which is to die and die again and again each time with no less pain. The cat minority of one is all that can be counted on to tell the truth. And what he has to tell on each return from hell is this: dying is what the living do. Dying is what the loving do. And the dead dogs are those who do not know that hell is where, to live, they have to go. Well, son, I'll tell you, life for me ain't been no crystal stair. It's had tacks on it, and splinters, and boards torn up, and places with no carpet on the floor, bare. But all the time I's been climbing on, I's been reaching landings, turning corners, sometimes going in the dark where there ain't been no light. So don't you set down now, boy. Don't you set down on the steps because you find it's kind of hard. Don't you fall now, because I's still going. I'm still climbing, honey. And life for me ain't been no crystal stair. I shoot the hippopotamus with bullets made of platinum. For if I use the leaden ones, his skin is sure to flatten them. Here's the happy bounding flea. You cannot tell the he from she. The sexes look alike, you see. But he can tell, and so can she. The honeybee is sad and cross and wicked as a weasel. And when she perches on you, boss, she leaves a little measle. The turtle lives twixt plated decks, which practically conceal its sex. I think it's clever of the turtle in such a fix to be so fertile. The primal termite knocked on wood, tasted it and found it good. And that is why your cousin May fell through her parlor floor today. The next poem, Revolution, is by Nikki Giovanni, one of the black revolutionary poets of the 1960s, who looked at our society and our art with a different eye. I wanted to write a poem that rhymes, but revolution doesn't lend itself to bebopping. Then my neighbor, who thinks I hate, asked, You ever write tree poems? I like trees. I said, I'll do a beautiful green tree poem. Peeked from my window to check the image. Noticed the schoolyard was covered with asphalt. No green. No trees grow in Manhattan. Well, then I thought the sky. I'll do a big blue sky poem. But all the clouds have winged low since Nodek was elected. Well, then I thought some more. And it occurred to me, maybe I shouldn't write at all. But clean my gun and check my kerosene supply. Perhaps these are not poetic times at all. Poetry also clarifies for us what's really important. What matters most in our lives? My clumsiest deer, whose hands shipwreck vases, and whose quick touch all glasses chip and ring, whose palms are bulls in china, burrs in linen, and have no cunning with any soft thing. Except all ill at ease fidgeting people. The refugee uncertain at your door, you make at home. Deftly you steady the drunk clamoring on his undulant floor. Unpredictable deer, a taxi driver's terror, shrinking from far headlights, pale as a dime, yet leaping before red epileptic streetcars, a misfit in any space, and never on time. A wrench in clocks and a solar system. Only with words and people and love, you move at ease. In traffic of wit, expertly maneuver and keep us all devotion at your knees. Forgetting your coffee spreading on our flannel, your lipstick grinning on my coat, so gaily in love's unbreakable heaven, our souls on glory of spilt bourbon float. Be with me, darling, early and late. Smash glasses. I will study rye music for thy sake. For if your hands should drop white and empty, all the toys of the world would break. When it is finally ours, this freedom, this liberty, this beautiful and terrible thing needful to man as air, usable as earth, when it belongs at last to our children, when it is truly instinct, brain matter, diastole, systole, reflex action, when it is finally won, when it is more than the gaudy mumbo-jumbo of politicians, this man, this Douglas, this former slave, this Negro beaten to his knees, exiled, visioning a world where none is hunted, none lonely, alien. This man, superb in love and logic, this man shall be remembered, oh, not with statues rhetoric, not with legends and poems and wreaths of bronze alone, but with lives grown out of his life, with lives fleshing his dream of the beautiful, needful thing. But He Was Cool by Don L. Lee is subtitled, Or He Even Stopped for Green Lights. It's a poem about knowing who you are. And in the face of the defining power of roles our society imposes on us, still trying to find a sense of justice,
and keeping your eyes on the truth of the American experience.
Super cool! Ultra black, he had a tan purple. He had a beautiful shade. He had a double natural that would put the sisters to shame. His dashikis were tailor-made. His beads were imported seashells from some black country I never heard of. He was triple hip. His tikis were hand-carved out of ivory and came express from the motherland. He would greet you in Swahili, say goodbye in Yoruba. Ooh, Jim, he'd be so cool and intelligent. Cool, cool, super cool, real cool. He was so cool, he was uncooled by other blacks cool. Cool, cool, so cool, ultra cool, bopped icebox, cool. So cool, his wine didn't have to be cool. Him was air-conditioned cool. Cool, cool made me cool. Now, ain't that cool? Cool, cool, so cool, him nicknamed Refrigerator. Cool, cool, super cool, really cool. He didn't know. After Detroit, Newark, Chicago, Watts, etc., we had the hip. Cool, cool, super cool, really cool. To be black is to be very hot.
I cannot praise a fugitive and cloistered virtue, unexercised and unbreathed, that never sallies out and sees her adversary, but slinks out of that race where that immortal garland is to be run for, not without dust and heat. Assuredly, we bring not innocence into this world. We bring impurity much rather. That which purifies us is trial, and trial is by what is contrary. That virtue, therefore, which is but a youngling in the contemplation of evil and knows not the utmost that vice promises to her followers and rejects it, is but a blank virtue, not a pure. Her whiteness is but an excremental, external whiteness. General, your tank is a strong machine. It can break down a wood, crush 100 men. But it has one drawback. It needs a driver. General, your plane is a strong machine. It flies faster than storm, carries more than an elephant. But it has one drawback. It needs a flyer. General, man is a wonderful machine. He can fly and he can kill. But he has one drawback. He can think. Don't show me any more pictures. I don't want to know about children in horse carts, about men in cattle cars, about women being taken away, about mass goodbyes, unearthly cries. Let me pretend my people were kings in freedom, that the children were princes on horseback, that the women were queens of it all. Throw away those pictures, I said. I don't want to know. No. My grandparents were not murdered. No, my parents were not slaves. No, my arm has no number. It happened once to another tribe. It happened once in another age. Put away those pictures, I said. Don't show them around my house. How can I tell my children we were treated worse than rubbish, for the garbage men here wear gloves? of it all. Don't show me anymore. Don't tell me anymore. Don't. Sonia Sanchez is another of the black revolutionary poets who watched a World Series baseball game and saw something different than most of us see. Oh, say, can you see on the baseball field all the fans clapping for their black players? Yeah, there ain't nothing like a black man playing in the noonday sun for us fun-loving spectators. Why, sometimes they seem even human. That is to say, every now and then. Hooray! Hurrah! Hooray! My, that dude's tough on that mound. Can't get no batters past him. Wonder where he was found. Makes you wonder if this is still a white man's game. Who's that flexing his white muscles? Oh, God, yes, another white hero to save us from total blackness. Carl Yastrzemski? 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 Yeah. It's America's most famous pastime. And the name of the game ain't baseball. And one morning, while in the woods, I stumbled suddenly upon the thing. Stumbled upon it in a grassy clearing guarded by scaly oaks and elms. And the sooty details of the scene rose, thrusting themselves between the world and me. There was a design of white bone slumbering forgottenly upon a cushion of ashes. There was a charred stump of a sapling pointing a blunt finger accusingly at the sky. There were torn tree limbs, tiny veins of burnt leaves, a scorched coil of greasy hemp, a vacant shoe, an empty tie, a ripped shirt, a lonely hat, and a pair of trousers stiff with black blood. And upon the trampled grass, there were buttons, dead matches, butt ends of cigars and cigarettes, peanut shells, a drained gin flask, and a whore's lipstick. Scattered traces of tar, restless arrays of feathers, and the lingering smell of gasoline. And through the morning air, the sun poured yellow surprise into the eye sockets of a stony skull. And while I stood there, my mind was frozen with a cold pity for the life that was gone. The ground gripped my feet. My heart was circled by icy walls of fear. The sun died in the sky. A night wind muttered in the grass and fumbled with the leaves on the trees. The woods poured forth hungry yelpings of hounds. The darkness screamed with thirsty voices. The witnesses rose and lived. The dry bones stirred, rattled, lifted, melting themselves into my bones. The gray ashes formed flesh, firm and black, entering into my flesh. Cigars and cigarettes glowed. The gin flask passed from mouth to mouth. The whore smeared lipstick red upon her lips. And a thousand faces swirled around me, clamoring that my life be burned. And then they had me, stripped me, battering my teeth into my throat till I swallowed my own blood. My voice was drowned in the roar of their voices, and my black, wet body slipped and rolled in their hands as they bound me to the sapling.
My skin clung to the bubbling hot tar falling from me in limp patches, and the down and quills of the white feathers sank into my raw flesh, and I moaned in my agony. Then my blood was cooled mercifully, cooled by a baptism of gasoline, and in a blaze of red I leaped to the sky as pain rose like water boiling my limbs. Begging, panting, I clutched childlike, clutched to the hot sides of death.
Now I am dry bones, and my face a stony skull, staring in yellow surprise at the sun. Poetry makes us more sensitive to others. We walk in the shoes of other people. Consider first Mr. Flood, an old, old man, and all his friends that died before him.
Old Evan Flood, climbing alone one night over the hill between the town below and the forsaken upland hermitage that held as much as he should ever know on earth again of home, paused warily. The road was his, not a native near. And old Evan, having leisure, said aloud for no one else to hear, "Well, Mr. Flood, we have the harvest moon again, and we may not have many more. The bird is on the wing, the poet says. And you and I have said it here before. Let's drink to the bird." With that, he raised up to the light the jug which he had gone so far to fill, and answered huskily, "Well, Mr. Flood, since you propose it, I believe I will." Alone, as if enduring to the end a valiant armor of sacred hopes outworn, he stood there in the middle of the road like Roland's ghost winding his sacred horn. Below him, in the town among the trees, where friends of other days had honored him, a phantom salutation of the dead rang thinly till old Evan's eyes were dim. Then, as a mother lays her sleeping child down gently, fearing he may wake, he set the jug down gently with trembling care, knowing that most things break. And only when assured that on firm earth it stood, as the uncertain lives of men and women assuredly did not, he paced away. And with his hand extended, paused again. "Well, Mr. Flood, we have not met like this in a long time. Many a change has come to both of us, I fear, since last it was we had a drop together. Welcome home." Convivially returning with himself, again he raised the door and answered, "Well, Mr. Flood, since you insist, I might. Only a very little." "No more, sir, that will do. For old lang syne, that will do." And apparently it did. And old Evan evidently thought so too. For soon, amid the silver loneliness of night, he lifted up his voice and sang, secure with only two moons listening, until the whole harmonious landscape rang, "For old lang syne." The weary throat gave out. The last word wavered, And the song being done, again he raised the jug regretfully, then shook his head, and was again alone. There was not much that lay ahead of him, and there was nothing in that town below, where strangers would have shut the many doors that many friends had opened long ago. The doctor asked her what she wanted done with him that could not lie there many days. She was shocked to see how life goes on, even after death, in irritating ways, and mused how if he had not died at all, it would have been easier. Then there need not be the stiff disorder of a funeral everywhere, and the hideous industry, and the crowds of people calling her by names she had never even seen before. But only watching by his bed once more, and sitting silent if a knocking came. Then at length she answered, feeling the doctor's eyes, "I don't know what you do exactly when a person dies." I know of nowhere in all literature where death shows its ambivalence more clearly. Old, confused King Lear has just found his daughter dead, wrongfully hanged. And we see the assurance in his mind that she is dead, of course, but the almost crazy hope that can't be true and that maybe she lives. He carries her out among the people. Should mist or stain the stone, why then she lives. A plague upon you, murderers, traitors all! I might have saved her! Now she's gone forever. Cordelia, Cordelia, stay a little. Huh? What is thou sayest? Her voice was ever soft, gentle, and low, an excellent thing in woman. And I have killed the slave that was a-hanging thee. Did I not, fellow? I have seen the day when my good biting sword would have made them skip. I am old now. And these crosses spoil me. Who are you? Mine eyes are not of the best, I'll tell you straight. And my poor fool is hanged. No. No. No life. Why should a dog, a horse, a rat have life, and thou no breath at all? Poetry often clarifies for us what we believe in. And in this very short 10-second poem, don't miss Langston Hughes' comment on institutionalized religion. In an envelope marked personal, God addressed me a letter. In an envelope marked personal, I've given my answer. The wise guys tell us that Christmas is kid stuff. Maybe they got something there. 2,000 years ago, three wise guys chased a star across the continent to bring frankincense and myrrh to a kid born in a manger with an idea in his head. And as the bombs crash all over the world today, the real wise guys know that we've all got to go chasing stars again in the hope that we can get back some of that kid stuff born 2,000 years ago. If you were to ask, years after he completed the journey, one of the Magi to describe his story, this might be his response. Cold coming we had of it. It's the worst time of year for a journey. Such a long journey. The waves were deep, the weather sharp, the very dead of winter. The camels sore-footed and galled, refractory, lying down in the melting snow. There were times we regretted our summer palaces on slopes, the terraces and the silken girls bringing sherbets. And the camel men, cursing and grumbling and running away, wanting their liquor and women. The night fires going out, the lack of shelters, the cities hostile. The towns unfriendly, the villages dirty and charging high prices. We had a hard time of it. At the end, we preferred to travel all night, sleeping in snatches, with those voices singing in our ears, saying that this was all folly. Then at dawn, we arrived at a temperate valley, wet below the snow line, smelling of vegetation, a running stream and a watermill beating the darkness. And three trees in the low sky. And an old white horse galloped away in the meadow. And we arrived at a tavern. Vine leaves over the lintel, six hands in the open door dicing for pieces of silver, feet kicking the empty wineskins. But there was no information, so we continued. And arrived at evening, not a moment too soon finding the place. It was, you may say, satisfactory. All this happened a long time ago, I remember. And I would do it again.
but set down this. Set down this. Were we led all that way for death or for birth? There was a birth, certainly, for we had evidence and no doubt. I have seen birth and death. This birth was a hard and bitter agony for us, like death, our death. At the end, we returned to these places, these kingdoms, but no longer at ease here in the old dispensations with an alien people clutching their gods. I should be glad of another death. How we try to clean it up, that manger mess in Bethlehem, make the stables courtly. Carols dance with light, wassail carries charity and cheer, Bema porcelains present a creche all done in white, exquisite, lovely to the touch. I bought the rabbit, it was what I could afford. Dear burning babe, and is this wrong? We are not magi bearing gifts of gold to be refined. We bring to Bethlehem our wretchedness, ourselves. We know the ugliness, and touch your soiled straw for beauty. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and ran away to where there were no rootless Christmas trees hung with candy canes and breakable stars. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and ran away to where there were no gilded Christmas trees. There were no tinfoil Christmas trees, no tinsel Christmas trees, no gold Christmas trees, no pink plastic Christmas trees, no powder blue Christmas trees hung with electric lights and circled by tin electric trains and clever cornball relatives. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and ran away to where no intrepid Bible salesman covered the territory in a two-tone Cadillac, and where no Sears and Roebuck creches complete with plastic babe in the manger arrived by parcel post, the babe by special delivery, and where no televised wise men praised the Lord Calvert whiskey. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and ran away to where no fat, handshaking stranger dressed in a red flannel suit and a fake white beard went around passing himself off as some sort of North Pole saint crossing the desert into Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, in a Volkswagen sled drawn by rollicking Adirondack reindeer with German names and bearing sacks of humble gifts from Saks Fifth Avenue for everybody's imagined Christ child. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and ran away to where no Bing Crosby carolers moaned of a tight Christmas, and where no Radio City Angels ice skated wingless through a winter wonderland into a jingle bell heaven daily at 8:30 with midnight mass matinees. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and softly stole away into some anonymous Mary's womb again, where in the darkest night of everybody's anonymous soul, he awaits again. in unimaginable and impossibly immaculate reconception. The very craziest of second comings.
Poetry helps us to celebrate our energies, to celebrate our gifts. I thank you, God, for most this amazing day, for the leaping greenly spirits of trees, and for the true blue dream of sky, and for everything which is infinite, which is natural, which is yes. For I, who have died, am alive again today. This is the sun's birthday. This is the birthday of life and of love and of wings and of that big, great happening illimitably earth. How should tasting, touching, hearing, seeing, breathing, any lifted from the know of nothing, human merely being, dot unimaginable you? Now the ears of my ears are awakened. The eyes of my eyes are opened. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood. I'm sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other as just as fair perhaps and having a better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear, though as for that the passing there had worn them really about the same. Oh, I saved the first for another day. Yet, knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this somewhere, ages and ages hence, with a sigh. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Three hundred years ago, John Milton suggested for me why anyone would bother to memorize poetry. I have long since been persuaded that to say or do anything worth memory and imitation, no purpose or respect should simply move us, than simply the love of God and of humankind.